This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, May 31st, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Washington, lawmakers in the House reject a bill that would have restricted abortions based on gender. Protesters from around the world gather in California to call for Chevron to take more responsibility for the effects of the company's operations in their communities. And across the U.S., more local law enforcement is considering the use of drones. We'll discuss some of the implications. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm George Lavender, with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Syrian government troops have shelled the town of Hula less than a week after a massacre in which at least 108 people died. As evidence of more killings emerged, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the situation in Syria as, quote, at a tipping point. On Wednesday, UN observers in eastern Syria discovered the bodies of 13 people. They had been killed with their hands tied behind their backs. According to Syrian activists, more than 12,000 people have been killed since the uprising began. Today, a commander with the rebel Free Syrian Army called on the UN envoy Kofi Annan to declare an end to the ceasefire. Riyad al-Assad said the group should be allowed to resume military operations in the face of ongoing government attacks. Also on Thursday, shopkeepers across the country closed their businesses in a new show of opposition to the regime. The strike was reported in Damascus and Aleppo. Egypt's emergency law, which gave police extensive powers to arrest and detain people, expires today. The law has been in place continuously for 29 years and was last renewed by the Egyptian parliament 2 years ago. Despite the law expiring, many Egyptians are concerned that the ruling military council will continue to exercise many of the powers that the law granted government forces. In a statement, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces said that the army will continue its national and historic responsibility. In Gaza, hundreds of people took part in a funeral for 12 Palestinians whose bodies were today returned by Israel. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
A large crowd took part in the funeral procession in Gaza City. Some of the bodies returned today had been held for several years in what Israel calls the Numbers Graveyard. Abu Ja'far al-Khatib is a brother for Khalid al-Khatib. Khalid was killed during an armed attack in 1995 on an Israeli military bus in the Gaza Strip.
We have been in constant sadness for the past 17 years, but now we have received his corpse. We are relieved. We feel better now that we are able to bury my brother.
Israel says the move is a gesture of goodwill to the Palestinian Authority. Another 80 corpses were returned to the West Bank city of Ramallah, where President Mahmoud Abbas hosted a formal reception ceremony. Palestinian Minister of Prisoners Affairs Isa Karaka says that Israel will return more corpses in the course of the next month, but it is unclear how many will be released. Israel still holds the remains of more than 200 Palestinians. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Hundreds of people have been arrested by Chinese security forces in the capital of Tibet. Reports from Lhasa say the arrests come just days after two people set themselves on fire in the city in an apparent protest against 60 years of Chinese control. According to Al Jazeera, eyewitnesses to the self-immolations have been detained, and Tibetans who live outside the city have been forced to leave. On Wednesday, a woman in southwestern China also burnt herself to death. The recent self-immolations brings the reported number of people who have set themselves on fire in Tibet this year to 25. In India, a nationwide strike called by opposition groups to protest an increase in fuel prices shut down parts of the country. FSRN's Jasvinder Sigal reports.
Shops, schools, gas stations and businesses were closed in many parts of the country. The strike was called by parties from both the left and right wing in India after an 11% hike in the price of gas. Several cities were completely shut down by the strike and thousands of people were stranded at rail stations, airports and bus terminals. N.K. Gupta was among the protesters. He says the government should act immediately to bring down the price of gas.
All businesses are closed and this is because of the wrongdoing of the government. We are compelled to take to the streets to protest against the rise in the price of gas.
In the capital city of New Delhi, police have detained more than 800 protesters. Violence between police and protesters was reported in some parts of the country. The national government is now considering of rolling back gas prices Jaswinder Sehgal, FSR in Jaipur, India.
In Philadelphia, closing arguments were heard today in the trial of a Roman Catholic priest accused of covering up the sexual abuse of children. From Common Pleas Court in Philadelphia, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
Monsignor William Lin is the highest church official to be tried for his involvement in child sexual abuse. Lin is a former secretary of clergy in the Philadelphia Archdiocese, where he oversaw 800 Philadelphia priests, including Reverend James Brennan. Brennan has been charged with attempted rape, while Lin is accused of covering it up. Prosecutors argue Lin transferred known abusers to other parishes to protect the church. Lin has been charged with conspiracy and child endangerment. He faces up to 28 years in prison if convicted. The defense maintains that he was just following orders. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
A U.S. appeals court in Boston has ruled that a law which defines marriage as the union between a man and a woman is unconstitutional. In a unanimous decision, the court found that the Defense of Marriage Act discriminates against same-sex couples because it denies them the same rights given to heterosexual couples. The judges agreed with a 2010 decision which found that the law interfered with the rights of individual states to define marriage. They also ruled that the act prevents gay couples from claiming the same federal benefits as heterosexual couples. President Obama announced last year that the Justice Department would no longer defend the law. And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Oakland, California, I'm George Lavender.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The debate over women's rights and reproductive rights continues on Capitol Hill today as the House of Representatives rejected a bill that would have criminalized sex-selective abortions and prosecuted doctors for failing to report even a suspicion that an abortion is based on the gender of the fetus. Supporters said the bill advances civil rights and gender equality, but many minority rights groups and health professionals opposed it, saying it would only exacerbate the harassment of women of color who seek abortions. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details.
Though nearly every Republican and more than a dozen Democrats voted for the Prenatal Non-Discrimination Act, or PRENDA, it failed to get the two-thirds majority needed to pass. But its supporters say they'll keep pushing for the measure in the future to combat what they call gendercide. New Jersey Republican Chris Smith, a co-sponsor of PRENDA, told reporters Thursday the abortion of female fetuses is the real war on women.
For most of us, it is a girl is cause for enormous joy, happiness, and celebration. But in many countries, including our own, it can be a death sentence. Today, the three most dangerous words in China and India are, it's a girl. We cannot let this happen or continue to happen here.
Though Smith described a growing body of evidence of sex-selective abortions in the U.S., he admitted it's mainly anecdotal and faulted abortion providers who keep their clients' information confidential for the lack of hard data on the issue.
Nobody knows because of the secrecy that surrounds many of the abortion clinics in the U.S. So we need more studies, obviously, but we know it's a problem all over the world. We know it's a problem here, and it's legal in all but four states of the United States.
Sex-selective abortion in some countries has been documented by the United Nations and condemned by the State Department. But opponents of PRENDA say House Republicans used that information to stereotype and discriminate against Asian American women. The original bill also criminalized abortions based on race, but that language was removed in committee after minority groups and lawmakers protested. Miriam Young with the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum testified against PRENDA at a hearing last December and has continued organizing against it. She told FSRN both versions of the bill send the message that women, and women of color in particular, can't be trusted.
It is hypocritical, cynical, and also very patronizing. The fact is, you know, women of color are leaders in our communities, backbones of our families, and we have the ability to make decisions over our bodies.
Young called the Prenatal Non-Discrimination Act a wolf in sheep's clothing, saying it would have encouraged discrimination. Responding to these and other criticisms at Thursday's press conference, Lila Rose with the anti-abortion group Live Action clarified that the bill's backers are not suspicious of women of color, but more of their husbands, boyfriends, and in-laws.
Some Southeast Asian women or Asian women here in the U.S. or Indian women or just regular women are being coerced to have sex-selective abortions.
One provision of Prenda threatened up to 5 years in jail for anyone who coerces, pays for, or transports a woman across state lines for the purposes of obtaining a sex-selective abortion, and the organization that provided the procedure would lose all federal funding. When the bill came to the House floor for debate, California Democrat Barbara Lee said these provisions targeting doctors and clinics would threaten women's health.
It would forever change the doctor-patient relationship as we know it by casting suspicion on doctors that serve communities facing the greatest health disparities, many of which are minority communities. And doctors should not be criminalized for providing constitutionally protected care.
Lee cited many health organizations that opposed the bill, including the American Congress of Gynecologists and Obstetricians, the American Public Health Association, and the National Association of Nurse Practitioners in Women's Health. In letters to Congress, the groups shared concerns that the bill would require that medical and mental health professionals violate patient confidentiality. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Also in Washington, protesters marched through the city ahead of Walmart's annual shareholder meeting tomorrow in Arkansas. The company has come under increased scrutiny for allegations of bribery in Mexico and its labor practices. On Wednesday, Walmart announced it is ending its membership in the American Legislative Exchange Council, the corporate lobbyist group tied to numerous state laws, including the Stand Your Ground gun law in Florida and Arizona's anti-immigrant SB 1070 law. The actions in D.C. are part of a campaign to draw attention to shareholder meetings of some of the world's biggest and most powerful corporations. On Wednesday, protesters gathered in San Ramon, California, for the shareholder meeting of Chevron. Representatives came from across the world to call for the corporation to take responsibility for its effect on their communities. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer reports.
Outside the San Ramon, California headquarters of the Chevron company, about 150 people waved signs at passing cars and shared stories of what they say is an unaccountable corporation doing business all over the world. Nguyen Tan with the Burmese American Democratic Alliance said the situation in his home country typifies the way Chevron operates in many nations.
Now, as we speak in Burma, every city, larger city, people are protesting because they have no power. But you imagine, Burma is the largest exporter of gas. Thanks to Chevron, they are looting our resources. Shame to Chevron! Shame to Chevron!
Activists traveled to the shareholders' meeting from Nigeria, Angola, Ecuador, Brazil, and elsewhere. Many were able to get inside the meeting itself using shareholder proxies and speak their piece. MM Okon, executive director of the Kebechabi Women Development and Resource Center in Nigeria, said she asked Chevron CEO John Watson to meet with local women and do more to mitigate the effects of an offshore fire that burned for 46 days earlier this year.
It is unfortunate that the fire incident that took place in January this year, that it doesn't really mean anything to Chevron. They don't care whether people died. They don't care about the health impact of that incident. They only care about the money. And I have pointed it out to them that they need to do something to address that situation.
True Cost of Chevron organizer Antonia Yuhas says CEO John Watson didn't address many of the core issues which were raised during the public comment period.
He failed to adequately present the risk that his operations have caused to his shareholders. He failed to mention utterly his oil spills in Brazil. The Brazilian government is threatening as much as $22 billion, with a B, dollars in fines, yet he did not mention Brazil once.
In fact, Brazilian Oil Workers Union representative Uo Moraes was not allowed in. According to a Chevron spokesperson, he lacked the proper shareholder proxy. Carolyn Kasdan with the United Steelworkers translates for Moraes after they both were rebuffed at the front door.
Sabemos que a justificativa não é o fato.
We know that the justification that they tried to deal with is not true.
Mas sim apenas a desculpa para uma falta de transparência e falta de democracia.
But we know that it is just their excuse for the lack of democracy and the lack of transparency.
So were you denied as well?
I was denied as well. I was one of the three who was denied.
Oh, and so what can you say about it?
He said it all. Chevron is treating us with total disrespect, the same way that they treat the people of Brazil and the government of Brazil.
One member of the United Steelworkers was able to enter the meeting and presented a resolution calling for a company report on workplace safety. But the resolution was opposed by Chevron's board and was soundly defeated by shareholders. Chevron spokesperson Brent Tippin.
We respect the rights of all individuals to express their opinions about our business operations. And we listen to those opinions and value what many people have to say in that respect.
There were numerous other shareholder resolutions proposed aimed at improving Chevron's environmental and human rights record. One called for Chevron to appoint an environmental expert, another for the company to reveal the financial risks of fracking. But these, along with resolutions calling for disclosure of the company's lobbying efforts and to break up the CEO's power, were all defeated by healthy margins. Nevertheless, Juhasz with the True Cost of Chevron campaign says she believes the group's strategy, which has long included shareholder activism, is working.
One of the things that we've been doing over a series of years is increasingly bringing the voice of the communities that directly feel the impacts of Chevron's operations to the shareholder meeting. The result of consistently hearing that voice is that more aggressive shareholder resolutions have been presented, and shareholders with much greater value in the company are backing them. Those resolutions have received enormous amount of press attention, an enormous amount of public attention. That then translates into, hopefully, increased requirements on the company to behave from the outside if that pressure can't be felt on the inside.
Indeed, it's not just activists pushing for change. The state of New York is the largest of 40 institutional investors who recently called on Chevron to consider paying the $18 billion in the Ecuadorian court case and meet with shareholders to discuss a resolution to the case. As for now, there's no indication the company will stop fighting in court. Andrew Stelzer, San Ramon, California, FSRN.
This week, we reported on the Obama administration's use of drone strikes in its targeted killing program abroad, but the use of drone technology is also on the rise within the U.S. Federal agencies, local law enforcement, and even private and public universities have sought to use drones for surveillance and information gathering. Now, some of them are starting to employ the technology. According to filings with the Federal Aviation Authority made public last month by a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, entities that have applied to the FAA for permission to use drones include Customs and Border Enforcement, Cornell University, and the University of Colorado, the police departments in Seattle, Washington, Ogden, Utah, and North Little Rock, Arkansas, and others. At least one sheriff's department in Texas has acquired a drone that has the capacity to carry crowd control weapons. For more, we're joined by Jay Stanley, senior policy analyst with the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's begin with the news from Montgomery County in Texas. There, according to the Sheriff's Department and the Houston Chronicle, the department has purchased a drone that could have the capacity to carry control weapons like tear gas, rubber bullets, and tasers. Is this a step forward from the use of domestic drones we've seen so far?
Yeah, that would definitely be a new leap into the unknown in the drone world. What we've seen so far is actually very limited deployments by a few police departments, as well as greater deployment by Customs and Border Patrol along the southern borders and a little bit along the northern borders, and some largely experimental uses by other public entities like universities. But the FAA has really been holding back the broad, wide-scale deployment of drones based on very legitimate safety issues. We can't have these sort of flying robots crashing into the earth or into other aircraft.
I want to ask about the FAA's role in this and recent legislative action from Congress. But first, talk about the drones themselves. The drone that was purchased by the Montgomery County in Texas was made by Vanguard Defense Industries, called a Shadow Hawk drone. In general, what kinds of drones are we talking about here, and what features do they have?
Well, drone technology varies widely from automated, unmanned aircraft of the size of 737 jets all the way down to tiny hummingbird-sized vehicles. And they can carry a variety of payloads, including pretty advanced surveillance equipment, things like night vision, see-through imaging, high-power zoom lenses, and that kind of thing. And they could conceivably, as this Texas sheriff was talking about, carry weapons, whether tasers, rubber bullets, tear gas for crowd control. That raises very serious issues. You know, tasers are sometimes called a non-lethal weapon, but they've been responsible for, or at least 500 people have died after being tased since 2001, according to Amnesty International in the United States. So I would call these less lethal weapons.
And there is a growing interest by local authorities in drone use. This month, Seattle's City Police Department received approval from the FAA to fly two unmanned aerial drones. This week, Virginia's Governor Bob McDonnell endorsed the idea of using drones in that state for law enforcement. What other concerns do you have about local entities expanding the use of drones?
Our biggest concern is that because drones are so much cheaper than other aircraft, like, you know, manned helicopters, and are likely, like, you know, like so many technologies these days, are likely to get more powerful and cheaper at the same time, that police departments will begin deploying them in droves, and that they will be used to create pervasive aerial surveillance systems over American towns and cities. The technology is getting to the point where, you know, networks of drones could communicate with each other and coordinate surveillance, so that really you could get an all-seeing eye over a city that is able to track individuals as they move around a town.
The FAA is responsible for making decisions about what drones can be used and coordinating that with other aircraft in the sky. Now, moving ahead, what do you see the FAA's role as? And give us an update on congressional action on this issue.
Well, Congress passed big legislation in February in the FAA Reauthorization Act, in which they drastically expanded the use of drones domestically. They basically ordered the FAA to make it much, much easier for public entities like police departments to use drones. And they also ordered the FAA to make it possible for commercial use of drones, which will greatly expand the uses of drones. And we really need to put in place some protections in the face of this coming onslaught to make sure that we can gain the benefits of this technology, and this technology does have benefits, whether it's, you know, finding a child lost in the woods, and environmental surveys. We want to be able to get the benefits of this technology without having to worry that, you know, we're allowing the police to create, you know, dragnet surveillance systems in our skies. And so we need to put in place some good rules to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Jay Stanley is Senior Policy Analyst with the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project. He joined us from Washington, D.C. to discuss the domestic use of drones. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Residents of Srinagar in Indian-administered Kashmir have long faced the risks of an armed struggle and a government's brutal military response. But these days, they are facing a different danger. Stray dogs seem to be the latest scare, with attacks on children and the elderly on the rise. The civic administration appears unable to cope with the situation. Animal rights activists cite laws to prevent the mass killing of dogs, but alternative measures haven't yet stopped the problem. FSRN's Shanawaz Khan reports.
It's a sunny afternoon, and most of the stray dogs in this posh locality of Srinagar are sleeping and lazing, and there are plenty of them.
Very too much dogs here. It's very too itne kutte hain yahan par ki unko ye nahi raat ko na yahan par bhi aaoge na.
One of this neighborhood's residents is Joginder Sehgal. He says that by evening the dogs will become hostile.
You see, this is 100-200 dogs are still there. This is very dangerous.
As Joginder talks, 10-year-old Manmeet is biking in the street. She stops after spotting some sleeping dogs nearby and moves towards a passerby to take cover.
I'm very scared of them. Just yesterday I saw a woman with two kids. She was chased and was bitten by dogs.
The problem of stray canines is not restricted to this locality. It's a widespread problem in Srinagar. Official figures put the number of stray dogs in the city at more than 91,000. Reports of dog bites and even packs of dogs mauling children are frequent. The number of patients visiting the anti-rabies clinics in Kashmir has been increasing. For the last few years, the central hospital in Srinagar treats around 20 dog bite victims every day. Dr. Salim Qadri is an associate professor at the Social and Preventive Medicine Department at Government Medical College, Srinagar.
Last year, we have around 6,000 dog bites. In just last 4 years, we have around 65,000 dog bites reported in our clinics, at our anti-rabies clinic in our SMHS hospital, as well as in the various clinics in the Directorate of Health Services, Kashmir.
In 2007, the Srinagar Municipal Corporation attempted to tackle the dog menace with a massive culling operation to kill the strays. The plan attracted bad press, with the news dominating international headlines for days. Animal rights activists forced the Swig body to abandon the plan. Since then, the number of dogs has only increased, and so has the dimension of the problem. Last year, Nadeem Qadri, along with some fellow activists, went to a local court to press for a solution.
There are some people who feel that culling can be one of the options, and that options need to be restored in terms of saving the human population, because ultimately humans have the priority over the animals. That's what we are looking into, dimensions how this problem can be solved, can be mitigated, so that the people will live their life with human dignity.
Animal rights activists are rejecting any calls for dog cullings. Rahul Sehgal is the Asia Director of Humane Society International, an animal protection organization.
You cannot identify which is the problem dog, and you cannot do selective culling. You will blame every single dog, every friendly dog, every safe dog for the act of some dog which has acted in a way for which we don't even know the background of what was the reason. So I'm completely against culling because it is unscientific. It has not proven to be successful anywhere.
Officials say they are launching fresh strategies to tackle the menace. Jian Kasba heads the Srinagar Municipal Corporation.
Now we have a two-pronged strategy. One is that we have decided and we're going to enforce it that our lanes, by lanes are clean. And at the same time now we, in coordination with the National Animal Welfare Board, we're starting sterilization of the dogs. And I'm sure that by first week of May, the sterilizations would commence and we would be sterilizing around 20 to 40 dogs almost every day.
Qadri and Khan agree that quick and effective food waste disposal could tackle the problem to some extent. But unlike Kasba, they are not optimistic about the sterilization program.
By the time you sterilize 50 dogs, 500 more dogs will be born and will be on road, and the threat will just increase day by day.
Khan says that the Swig body needs to sterilize at least 500 dogs every day to make it effective. An earlier sterilization initiative launched in 2008 failed because it was poorly organized. In a place where human rights are rarely respected, the concern for dog lives sounds ironic to many. And even if the government's sterilization program succeeds this time, many residents question whether the dogs will stop biting. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Shannon Young, sitting in for Catherine Kopp. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.